Finally, I would like to look at a particular aspect of palliative care, which is called perinatal hospice. This is, I'd like to present this in the form of a clinical case and then a discussion of it. I've entitled it Death at the Beginning of Life, and I've pointed out that very often in our society, when a woman receives a prenatal diagnosis of an infant who has a terminal illness, that is an infant who will either die around the time of birth or before birth or very shortly afterwards, this diagnosis is in our society very widely, almost universally regarded as an indication for abortion. But there is an alternative, and there are institutions that are pushing to make this alternative more widely available, and this is very often described as perinatal palliative care or perinatal hospice. And the goal here is to extend to the infant who is dying and to the parents who are attempting to take care of the dying infant the same care, the same kind of palliative treatment that one would extend to any dying individual. A clinical case that I was involved with some time back is described here. There was an obstetrician at a hospital at which I consult who asked if it would be permissible to induce labor at this Catholic hospital in a patient, a pregnant woman, who was carrying a child with a lethal illness, an illness that is invariably fatal. There are no instances in which this illness is survived past a very short period of time, depending upon the severity of expression of this illness. And as I describe in the case, she was 24 years old. She'd previously had two healthy children. She was in her 28th week of pregnancy, that is to say, the child had reached the point of viability, and things had been normal up to that point, but now she had an ultrasound that showed many bony abnormalities of the child that she was carrying, and further tests and consultations with pediatricians and specialists in neonatal care yielded a diagnosis of very severe thanatophoric dysplasia, and there's a link you can follow if you wish to learn a little more about this illness, an invariably lethal condition. It was also associated with the development of polyhydramnios, that is a condition in which the woman's amniotic fluid was increasing, caused by the fact that the infant that she was carrying was unable to swallow properly. And so her obstetrician recommended that labor be induced because polyhydramnios can be associated with many other complications of pregnancy. This obstetrician was unsure whether this would be permissible at the hospital where I consulted because he was afraid some might misunderstand it as a kind of abortion, and he asked the neonatal team at St. Francis to discuss the issue with the spiritual care staff, that is the chaplains and other individuals involved in spiritual care, and with a bioethicist, who in this case was myself. We had a conference. We discussed all of these issues. And the neonatologist made it clear that even if the pregnancy were carried to full term, the results would be the same. The child would not be able to survive for more than a few hours or at most a few days, and there was a significant probability that the child would not be born alive. The cause of death would be immaturity of the lungs, which would remain immature even if the child were allowed to go to full term. It wasn't a question of simply developing more mature lungs. It was the nature of the disease itself that prevented the possibility of the infant developing mature lungs or being able to breathe normally. And in the opinion of the perinatologist, there would be no change in the prognosis, that is, what would be likely to be the result for the child if pregnancy were ended by inducing labor at this point, or if the woman carried the child to term. We tried to clarify the moral issues, and I've listed them there. The goal of induction was solely to treat the mother's hydramnios, that it was in order to treat the mother that this was being considered. The premature induction of labor would not alter the child's prognosis, and mother and father wanted to care for the child after delivery as much as possible, but they knew that there was no medical therapy that would be able to treat or even significantly extend their child's life, and so therefore they did not wish invasive therapies to be employed, and they wanted to care for the child in the mother's postpartum room, to offer the child comfort, warmth, to offer the child the opportunity of suckling, although the likelihood that the child could swallow was going to be extremely small, but they didn't want efforts to be made to unnecessarily prolong the dying process by putting the child on a respirator, which would be a very futile effort in this case anyway, or even by giving any kinds of medications or forcing the child to have intravenous lines or anything of that sort. So the social services and the spiritual care staff met with the parent well before this procedure was permitted or taken on, to make sure that the patient would receive psychological help, and that also that a chaplain would be available to baptize the child, which the parents desired. So the question arises then, what is, and this is number two, perinatal hospice? And this is a form of palliative care that is intended to support the child and the parents who choose to continue a pregnancy where the infant they're carrying is discovered to be suffering from a terminal illness. And I've given you a couple of links that you can explore on your own. The longer ones are links to organizations that promote this or describe it. The first is to the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and a form of their website allows one to search according to state to find individuals who are in accordance with the principles that they espouse. And the second is not a Catholic organization. It's an organization called perinatalhospice.org, which attempts to find centers which are willing to provide this kind of care. In other words, to provide an alternative for parents who choose not to have the abortion that is inevitably recommended, and who can be enabled to deal with the terrible difficulty, the burden of caring for a child who is certainly dying, prepared ahead of time, and then support during that process by people who can make sure that, again, the child does not suffer without in any way trying to hasten the child's death, but at the same time also caring for the parents and for their needs. And the question naturally arises, what is the Church's approach to these issues? Well, let's look at them, and I've included here the ERDs, the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services, which are required of all Catholic healthcare institutions that are regard themselves as Catholic or are to be designated as such. And I'd invite you to look at these in detail. I'm only going to highlight the portions that are particularly relevant to this circumstance that we're considering. Obviously, number 45, abortion before viability. And remember, this infant has reached the age of viability. That is, any directly intended termination of pregnancy before viability, and certainly the destruction of a viable fetus, is never permitted in any Catholic institution. Number 47, treatments that have as their direct purpose the cure of a proportionately serious pathological condition of a pregnant woman are permitted when they cannot be safely postponed until the unborn child is viable, even if this will result in the death of the unborn child. Thus, for example, a mother with a very serious illness that requires a medication that could unfortunately have the side effect of harming her unborn child could receive that medication if the intention were simply to treat the mother. A mother, for example, who has life-threatening cancer can receive cancer therapy even if the drug will have as its side effect the harming of the unborn child. This is a principle, as we've seen, the principle of double effect. And in this case, it's only to some extent applicable, although we did talk about it being applied. The child had reached the point of viability, but she certainly had a proportionately serious pathological condition. And again, the induction was in no way intended to harm the child. It was intended to treat the mother. And if we drop down then to number 49, for a proportionate reason, that is a reason that outweighs opportunity of or obligation to wait until the end of pregnancy, labor may be induced after the fetus is viable, after the age of viability has been reached, which was the case here. If we then look at part five, which have to do with issues in care for the dying, the use of life-sustaining technology is judged in light of the Christian meanings of life, suffering, and death. On the one hand, one is to avoid the extreme of insisting useless or burdensome technology. And again, the parents, in considering what the child's situation would be when it was born, had already decided not to use burdensome or useless technology. And on the other hand, one wants to avoid withdrawing technology with the intention of causing death. If we then drop down to number 55, and this is so important but so difficult often in our own day, that people should be provided with whatever information is necessary to help them understand their condition and to prepare for death. But unfortunately, in the secular medical community, there's often a desire to avoid mentioning death, and this is one of the reasons why some physicians are very nervous about or even unwilling to employ palliative care at the end of life. We've already seen what is detailed in number 56, that there is an obligation to use ordinary and proportionate means, which are those that in the judgment of the patient, and in this case, it's a question of judging as far as the care that will be offered to the child, the substituted judgment, the parents trying to decide what the child would want, what is in the child's best interests, avoiding things that do not offer a reasonable hope of benefit, using things that don't entail excessive burden, and don't involve excessive expense. And a person has the right, as we've seen, to forego extraordinary or disproportionate means. And I've included then the conclusion that the Bioethics Committee determined that in this instance, if one invoked or looked at the principle of double effect, the requirements were certainly fulfilled. The infant had reached the age of viability, and furthermore, the action, induction of labor, is itself morally neutral, and would in this case be beneficial to the mother without harming or changing the prognosis of the child. And one way of testing this is to ask if it had been possible or safe for the mother to carry the child to term, would she have done so? And the answer was absolutely yes. The only reason that the induction was being considered was because of her polyhydramnios. So the intention of the parents was to deliver the child in as normal a way as possible and then to care for the child as best they could. And so it was concluded that induction of labor could take place. All of this was explained to all of the medical staff concerned, especially the labor and delivery and postpartum staff would be assisting the patient's parents, the patient and then she and her husband in caring for their newborn child. Everyone was comfortable with the decision. The induction was performed without complications. The child lived for only 2 hours after delivery. The mother cared for the child and was very grateful for the opportunity to be able to care for the child during its very short life. So again, this is a reminder that the principles of palliative care can be applied to individuals at the end of life, whether they've reached the end of a long life or the end of an extremely short one. But we also have to bear in mind that when we speak of palliative care, it's always important to highlight that this is not just hospice, this is not just end-of-life care. It is providing care in the treatment of symptoms for people with pain and other symptoms that can be effectively treated medically by people who are properly trained in this very specific medical art and technique.